Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a purge of princes in Saudi Arabia, a new crown prince shaking things up all over, Jared Kushner in the wings, and the prime minister of Lebanon in or out, but not at home, looking sometimes like a prisoner to some in Saudi Arabia. This hour On Point, what is going on in the Middle East? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We had this November 4th, Lebanon's prime minister, this is Saad Hariri. He was in Riyadh, not home, not in his own capital, but in Saudi Arabia's capital of Riyadh, and from there announcing his resignation in a televised speech. Here's some of that, November 4th.
I hereby announce my resignation as Prime Minister from the Lebanese government, knowing that the will of the Lebanese is stronger and their determination is steadfast and will overcome any attempts to impose any custodianship over them from powers either inside or outside our country.
Okay, resigning from not his home country, but from a different country. Imagine if Donald Trump had resigned in Beijing. Not exactly the same, but still pretty weird. And this reference in that announcement on November 4th, the Lebanese prime minister saying he's resigning and sharply criticizing Hezbollah, a big, which has been a political partner of his in Lebanon, and of course, very closely linked to Saudi enemy Iran.
I would like to say to Iran and its followers that they will be losers in their intervention in the Arab affairs. Our nation will wake up as it did in the past, and their hands in the region will be cut off.
Could have been dictated by a Saudi foreign minister. Maybe it was. There was this that he said, and I don't have an English interpretation of this, but we'll do some. Here's one more from that November 4th speech. Here's, again, the Lebanese then prime minister saying, we're living through times similar to those before the assassination of Rafik Hariri, that was his father, of course, killed in 2005. He says, I am aware of what is being plotted to target my life. And that's just the beginning of the story unfolding in Lebanon and Saudi Arabia in recent weeks. Joining me today from Washington is Hanin Gadar, visiting fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, expert on Lebanon, Arab, and Islamic politics, spent years in Lebanon as a journalist covering the Middle East. You can find her one of her latest pieces, headlined Saudi Arabia's War on Lebanon, at our website, onpointradio.org. Hanin Gadar, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much.
Can you please explain what you mean when you say you see evidence of a Saudi Arabian war on Lebanon?
Yes. Let me start by talking about the context of this war. Lebanon, before Hariri's resignation, was not normal, was not really okay, was not doing that well. And we've had a national unity government headed by Prime Minister Saad Hariri until his resignation that was mostly formed in order to balance Hezbollah's power in Lebanon and give some kind of consensus for Lebanon. This didn't really work because we got a president that is Hezbollah's ally, Hezbollah's candidate, basically. We got a new electoral law that is going to consolidate Hezbollah's power over Lebanon and will probably get Hezbollah 70% of the seats in the parliament next year. So this was going in a very bad way, and Hariri was definitely trying to balance Hezbollah's power out, and it didn't really work. Until his meeting with Ali Akbar Vilayati in Beirut, one day before his resignation.
Who's that?
Ali Akbar Vilayati is the supreme leader, Iranian supreme leader's main consulate.
Okay.
So he is a very senior guy in Iran. He's Khamenei's right hand. And he came to Lebanon and met with Hariri and others. And he made a statement out of Hariri's place saying basically that Iran is the most powerful and the kingmaker of Lebanon, something like that. And then he left. And Hariri immediately after that went to Saudi Arabia and resigned the next day from there.
Wow.
So this context is very important. We need to know how this happened.
Can we hold that right there for just a second, Hanin? Because I know there's a lot more we want to learn, but some of these things are just like imminent right now. We had today We had the president, Mike Aoun of Lebanon, who I guess you're telling us is very Hezbollah aligned. Is that what you were saying?
Yes. Michel Aoun was Hezbollah's candidate from the very beginning.
Right.
And he is 100% Hezbollah's ally. He's the main he's the main Christian ally of Hezbollah.
He's saying today that the prime minister, Saad Hariri, is a prisoner in Saudi
yes.
Arabia. He's being detained there. I mean, this was the Saad Hariri on Sunday. He had this interview with Future TV. He brushed this off. Let's listen. So here's Lebanon's prime minister, still in Saudi Arabia, but telling the interviewer, let me tell you something, I am free here in the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and if I want to travel tomorrow, I could travel, and I have a family. It's my right to take care of my family. Is he free or not? Or do we have any idea, Hanin, to leave Saudi Arabia?
We're not sure. We're not sure. There's no sign that he's actually free. Everybody has visited him, couldn't really confirm that he is free. His decision came from Saudi Arabia, which indicates that this is a Saudi decision. This was not his decision. Until 2 weeks before his resignation, somebody asked him if he was going to resign, and he said definitely not. And he didn't really want to resign. And this happened after he was summoned to Saudi Arabia and was asked to resign. And the tone of his resignation was very similar to Saudi rhetoric against Iran. It wasn't his words, really. The interview was more about him speaking. It was more his tone, his words. The resignation was not his. That's for sure. This is not just about Lebanon. This is like Saudi's reaction to the regional Iranian behavior in the region, and Hariri's resignation is part of it. And it's whether he's free or not physically. This is not the issue. I think it's more about his decision as the prime minister of Lebanon. Is his decision independent or not? This is the question. And so far, even if he's free to move, and even if he comes back to Lebanon at this point, I'm not sure his decision is going to be independent. This is really a Saudi-Iranian war on Lebanon. This is what we're seeing today.
So the Iranian top dog comes, says, we're the kingmaker in Lebanon, and the next day you've got Hariri in Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
And then this unfolding resignation. But then he said on Sunday, well, no, maybe I'll go back and be prime minister.
He didn't say that.
Well, it was close. It was something like that, right?
He hinted at the possibility of him backing off his resignation, but he said also that he has conditions, that he's going to come back to Lebanon and meet with the president and discuss these conditions. And based on the result of this negotiation, he might back off.
I see.
Yeah, but these conditions are mostly, probably, so far, are going to be about Hezbollah's involvement in Yemen. And this is we also know that Yemen is a Saudi priority. He's going to come to Lebanon. He's going to sit with Michel Aoun, the president, and he's going to tell him that Hezbollah has to withdraw from Yemen. Michel Aoun, being Hezbollah's ally, he was going to tell him that I cannot do anything about it, because also we know that Hezbollah is not going to leave Yemen only because Saudi Arabia is threatening Lebanon.
Hezbollah is now helping the forces in Yemen that are resisting Saudi Arabia, you're saying?
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. They're helping. Hezbollah is not a Lebanese. You have to think about Hezbollah as a regional militia now, not a Lebanese party. So their decisions come from Iran, and Iran is very much invested in Yemen as much as they're invested in Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. So they're not going to leave Yemen. So he is going to submit his resignation after he hears the negative response in person. And then we're going to go to phase two. And phase two is not going to be about Hariri anymore. Mm-hmm. Phase two is going to be about what Saudi Arabia is going to do to Lebanon. So far,
can we hold it
war,
before we go there? What is the Saudis' leverage on the man who has been the prime minister, Saad Hariri? He looked so uncomfortable in these interviews. Even on Sunday, I mean, he was sweating. He looked very unhappy. What's their leverage on him? Do they have his family in the cellar, or do they have information on him, or his fortune is tied up? What is it?
I don't know about his fortune, but I don't think they have his family in a cellar. I don't think it's that bad. The thing is that he didn't want to resign, and he was forced to resign. This is pretty much it. We cannot really say for sure whether he's hostage or if family is in a cellar. We don't know.
But how do they force
him
to resign at gunpoint? What's their leverage? How can the Saudis just say you resign and he says yes? Why?
He's a Saudi citizen, and he went to Saudi Arabia. He went to Saudi Arabia, and they basically the resignation came from Saudi Arabia.
The Prime Minister of Lebanon is a Saudi citizen. He's got dual citizenship. I see. Okay.
He has a dual citizenship. Yes, okay. he's from his father. His dad, the former Prime Minister of Lebanon, Rafi al-Hariri, was given the citizenship of Saudi Arabia.
Why didn't he just say no? Children. I'm not resigning. I'm the Prime Minister of Lebanon, an independent state.
We know this is more complicated than that. This is Lebanon. This is Lebanon. Okay, so I don't think anyone in Lebanon is going to be in power if they're that independent, like from the president to the prime minister to the speaker of the house and every single politician. Everybody has a leverage on everybody on Lebanon. It's more complicated than being at gunpoint or not. He has a lot of businesses in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. He has family in Saudi Arabia, and it's more complicated than that. It's not black and white. It's complicated.
We get that. Saudi Arabia, you say, is at war, has a war on Lebanon. What do they want out of that? And by what means will they pursue this further?
Yeah, so we have to think about the regional context, not just mm-hmm. Lebanon. Lebanon mm-hmm. is not just like, this is not a Lebanese issue. Mm-hmm. The regional context is really about Iran and the region and Iran winning in the region. And this is, we got a point where Iran has won Lebanon completely, and they realized they couldn't do through Hezbollah, of course. They couldn't do anything about Iran and Lebanon anymore. In Syria, it's almost done. The land bridge is almost complete. It's a matter of time. Between Syria and Iraq, and mm-hmm. the land bridge is really like the Shia crescent, in other words, that is going mm-hmm. to link Tehran to Beirut via Iraq and Syria. Mm-hmm. And this land bridge is almost complete because the borders between Iraq and Syria are almost linked through, and the battle of Bukamal along the border, Deir ez-Zor and Bukamal, it's a matter of days before it happened. And today, Qasem Soleimani, the leader of the Quds force of the IRGC, was spotted around that area from the Iraqi border of the Bukamal. So they are going to declare victory. And declaring victory is very, 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 it's not a matter of completing the land bridge for logistical reasons. It's really symbolic. It's really about unifying the Shia and winning over Saudi Arabia and the region. And the Saudis, definitely for them, this is a huge deal. And no one is stopping them. The old administration did not do anything about it. The new administration apparently is not going to do anything about it. They're kind of like, Russia is going to solve the problem in Syria. And this is going to be an Iranian victory. So this is the issue.
You're incredible. And we're learning a lot here about what's really unfolding. It is big. And we want to try and get on top of it. Hanin Gadar, please stand by in Washington. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we are talking this hour about a purge of princes, about palace intrigue, a prime minister in limbo, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon. What is going on in the Middle East? It has been really wild in the last few weeks, the culmination of a whole lot of tension and maneuvering over time. Hanin Gadar is with us, visiting fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and you can join us as well. Have you been following all this news? Have you seen the Prime Minister of Lebanon resign from the capital of another country, Saudi Arabia? Then sort of backtrack. Have you watched as the new Saudi Arabian crown prince has been rounding up, arresting other princes right and left? What is really going on here with Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Jared Kushner's visits? Is this the Saudis girding for a real throwdown with Iran? Lebanon's prime minister, I guess he's still the prime minister, but he said earlier he'd resigned from Riyadh. But he talked with Future TV, and he told them that he's free to return to Lebanon, plans to return to his country soon. But he didn't look so great when he was saying all this. NPR's Ruth Sherlock was watching that interview from Lebanon's capital, Beirut. Here was her report.
On camera, Saad al-Hariri looks nervous and drained. At some moments, he even seems on the verge of tears. In this live interview with Future TV, his political party's channel from the Saudi capital Riyadh, Hariri denies being held hostage. He says he plans to return to Lebanon within days.
Listen to some of the kinds of things he was saying on Sunday. Here he is. The Lebanese, again, prime minister, resigned or not, I'm not sure. He says, I've submitted my resignation. I know it's not the most conventional way that most prime ministers would resign. I know this. But he said, I also had to follow a security procedures before I could go back to ensure my safety. People listening very closely to that. And then this. Said, yeah, it's better if I'd gone back to Lebanon to resign, but I was in danger. Needed to follow security procedures, and I decided I needed to do this resignation to cause a positive shock. Will he go back? Well, here he was. He said he would, and soon. He says, I'm not talking about weeks, I'm not talking about months, I'm talking about days. I will return to Lebanon. Hani Gadar is with us from Washington. Jamal Khashoggi is with us right now from Washington as well, a Saudi journalist, columnist, author. Now in a kind of self-exile in the United States, things have gotten pretty tough in some quarters in Saudi Arabia. Jamal Khashoggi, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Our listeners paying attention here and responding here. Dev says what Saudis have done is a total outrage. They kidnapped a sovereign head of state, holding him as a prisoner. Okay, but then here's another. Cincinnati says Khashoggi will tell you, so we'll ask you, that Hariri is held against his will, but Hariri himself is saying he's fleeing for his life, as he came to know Hezbollah plotting to kill him, as they did his father, 2005. So who you believe is your call. And then another listener, name in Arabic, I can't pronounce it here, I'm sorry, but it says he will return to Lebanon soon if he can secure his life from the assassination by the Hezbollah militia. Saudi Arabia will not forget what happened in 2005 when their guy, his father, Rafiq Hariri, died. What do you make of what we've seen in the last 2 weeks with Saad Hariri, Jamal?
Look, Saudi Arabia has a legitimate argument when it complains of Hezbollah activities, and as Hanin Ghadar put it very well and explained it, the expansionism policy of Iran and Hezbollah as a proxy for Iran, they leave Lebanon in the morning, go to Syria, fight in Syria, kill Syrians, return in the afternoon. Unchecked, they treat their wounded in Lebanese hospitals. They're conducting war out of Lebanon, and the Lebanese government is tolerating that. That is not acceptable. It should not be acceptable, neither to Saudi Arabian, to the French, to the Americans, but it is happening. But on the same time, the way the resignation, the pressure that was applied on Saad al-Hariri, it began to fire back on Saudi Arabia. What is the common denominator here? It is another hasty decision, another impulsive decision by Mohammed bin Salman without checking the facts, without having proper advisors around him who understand how to conduct world politics. And it led to Iranian winning over us and keep on advancing. And we, the Saudis, losing. And to me, as a Saudi citizen, yes, I worry of Iranian expansionism, and it's particularly sectarian expansionism that coming from mid-centric 1000s hatred. It had to be stopped. But with those hasty and impulsive policies, it will not. Something had to be done about that.
I wish you would help us then understand this news, which Hanin has described to us so well, in the context of what we've seen inside Saudi Arabia, with all these arrests of Saudi princes and other very big business people there. 11 princes, nearly 200 members of the business elite there, we are reading. You've got the crown prince, as you say, Mohammed bin Salman. He goes by MBS very often. This is the son of the king who's recently been made the crown prince. How does he see why is he arresting all these other princes and top business leaders? And is this related to the Saudi conflict with Iran? Is it related to the action with Saad Hariri? Is it related to Jared Kushner and his visit?
I didn't know about the latter, but it is not related to Iran, not related to Saad al-Hariri, except that Saad al-Hariri is also in business in Saudi Arabia, and he has two hats. He's beside being the prime minister of Lebanon, he is the chairman one of the large construction companies in Saudi Arabia that should be implicated in corruption, because it was big in corruption with the son of King Abdullah and King Fahd, of course, too. Mm-hmm. It's a common knowledge in Saudi Arabia. But so far, no charges has been issued to Saad al-Hariri about corruption.
So what's going on with the Crown Prince and all these arrests of princes? Is it just to root out corruption, or is it something more?
I wanted to root out corruptions. When it comes to this front, I totally support the Crown Prince in his purge on corruption. Corruption had been killing us in Saudi Arabia, and when we are talking about corruption in my country, we're not talking about a gold necklace you pass to the wife of a congressman. Mm-hmm. We are talking about princes who overcharge contracts by billions of dollars and ended up pocketing billions in their pockets. We are talking about depleting the Saudi wealth. According to MPS himself, he in an interview with Bloomberg last year, he made notice of $400 billion went to waste. He called them insufficient spending. That is corruption. So we are talking about maybe $1 trillion that went to waste in the last decade. So it had to be stopped. Another great things he is doing to me as a Saudi Arabian citizen, mm-hmm. He is taming down or curtailing the power and the influence of thousands of royalties. We in Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. we have about 10,000 royalties who act like little kings around us. Mm-hmm. They exploit their position. They enjoy favoritism. They get the better jobs. They get the better lands. And that is also not a proper way to run a country in the modern age. So at those two fronts, despite all the assumption that it is a power grab too, it could be a power grab, and even though he has all the power he needs, for me as a Saudi citizen, and I think every Saudi citizen, we should support him in purging the royalties and purging corruption.
It seemed like it kind of came out of nowhere. This was a Saturday, November 4th.
Yes.
Here's a report from Al Jazeera about the Saudis rounding up a whole bunch of the kingdom's political and business leadership.
Call it a surprise Saturday night shakeup. Saudi State TV reported that 11 princes, 3 current and dozens of former ministers have been detained as part of an anti-corruption probe.
Washington's response, here was State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert telling reporters the U.S. is talking with them all the time.
We continue to encourage the government of Saudi Arabia to pursue prosecution of corruption in a fair and transparent manner. That's something that we stress not only with Saudis, but with other governments as well. In terms of whether how these prosecutions may be going in the future, the government of Saudi Arabia would have to address that.
So kind of off you go, whatever you like. Haningadar, how are you looking at these things? Do you see a link between the timing of this incredible crackdown on Saudi princes and business people there, on corruption is the way it's been framed, and the ratcheting up of these tensions with Iran? Is there a relationship here, Hanin?
I'm not sure if there's a relationship between Hariri's resignation and the tension against Iran, but it's all part of the new Saudi methods. It's linked in that sense, let's say, you know, like escalation internally and regionally. But the link between Hariri's resignation and the internal purges, I'm not sure about that. He does have businesses inside Saudi Arabia. He might have some business partners among those who were arrested, but I don't think it's directly linked. It's Hariri's resignation is more about Iran's regional hegemony. I see it that way.
You've talked about Iran, mm-hmm. completing the so-called land bridge, that is a secure land link from Iran across Iraq into Syria and maybe Lebanon.
To the southern borders of Lebanon.
Yeah. Is this something that you think Saudi Arabia will tolerate, or there's been talk even of war lately? And, you know, this missile came out of Yemen, hit their air base. Mm-hmm. They were blaming Iran and maybe Hezbollah for that. Is that the kind of territory we're in? I mean, you say Saudi Arabia is making war on Lebanon. Mm-hmm. What do you mean exactly? How far does that go?
Okay, so I think this is something, the land bridge, it's something that worries a lot of people in the region, not just Saudi Arabia. It worries the Lebanese people, the Syrians, the people in the Gulf. It worries Israel, and it should worry also Western international community, because it's a huge victory for the IRGC. Even those who are looking to empower moderate forces in Iran, this should be a concern, because it's a victory for the IRGC.
Are you talking about for Iranian forces, the IRGC?
The IRGC is the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps.
Mm-hmm.
This is definitely worrying, and everybody wants this to be gone. Everybody wants to stop it, and everybody started to realize that a political solution is not going to stop it. A military solution could stop it, and maybe at one point Saudi Arabia thought that if they go for it, like if this kind of escalation would bring in the international community into a war against Iran and the region. The thing is, they were hoping that the anti-ISIS coalition, that now the war against ISIS, or let's say the caliphate, is almost done, that maybe at one point the coalition's composition and mission will change to become an anti-Iran coalition in Syria and Iraq. And basically fighting Iran's proxies in Syria, that is the Shiite militias, starting from Hezbollah and going down to the Hashd al-Shaabi, the popular mobilization forces, the Iraqis, the Afghanis, and the Pakistanis, and so on. This apparently seemed possible, but on the ground it sounded like it's not going to happen. Everybody seems to want this war, but no one seems to want to fight it. And everybody wants someone else to fight it for them. And this is not going to happen. So the war on Lebanon at this point, we're starting to feel that this is not going to happen in terms of a military war, but an economic war could be part of the punitive measures that the Saudis will start on Lebanon. Mm. An economic war means... It's very serious, because there are a lot of economic links between Lebanon and the Gulf, and it will lead to an economic crisis in Lebanon if it happened.
Jamal, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, is acting on so many fronts, acting rapidly. This has got a lot of people nervous. There's been money fleeing the country. He's seizing funds in this anti-corruption campaign, trying to bring some of that back, both internally and externally. He's acting in a very bold and in many ways non-traditional way. Where do you think this kind of leadership is taking the country, the region, Jamal?
A very basic answer. One-man rule always leads to a disaster. Mohammed bin Salman is doing the right things the wrong way. Saudi Arabia needs fixing. But he needs proper advisors around him. He needs to expand on involving the people in decision-making by allowing some form of democracy, some form of power sharing through an elective body. So we have to have that at the near future, otherwise one-man rule will lead to a disaster.
What about Jared Kushner and his... I mean, he's been in Saudi Arabia three times
yes.
this year. The last time, just late October, just before this sweep of arrests. What does that connection suggest to you?
Yes, I called it in one of my articles the Trump effect. I'm afraid Jared Kushner and President Trump are giving Mohammed bin Salman false promises, promises that they cannot fulfill. And someone needs to explain to MBS how the American system works, that the president cannot order the Pentagon to start striking against the Iranians in Syria.
You think he's telling Mohammed bin Salman, if you get into a shooting war with Iran or elsewhere, the U.S. will be there with you?
That is the only logical explanation for those hasty decisions, for this escalation against Iran, for this escalation against Hezbollah, while we all know, logistic-wise, that Saudi Arabia cannot start a war in its own against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Nor it cannot start a war against Hezbollah in Syria. It's not interested in Syria. This is something ironic, what I'm going to say. Now, the Iranians and the Saudis, they share a common enemy in Syria. It is democracy and political Islam. And this is where Mohammed bin Salman needs to sort out his enemies. Democracy has to prevail in Syria, and along with it, there will be political Islam. But he despises political Islam. So does the Iranians. So that's where he looked at Donald Trump for a solution that can do the miracle of freeing him and free Saudi Arabia from both political Islam and Iran. And I'm sure Donald Trump cannot do that.
We did see ISIS driven out of Raqqa, but that's quite different than sort of waving a wand over the whole region and having things change. And yet you say he feels permission to act in this very bold way, perhaps because of support from the president via Jared Kushner?
That's what they feel. That is the only logical explanation. ISIS is totally different from political Islam. ISIS is a radical movement. They don't believe in democracy. They don't believe in power sharing, and they had to be fought. But there will never be a future for democracy in the Arab world without involving political Islam. And MBS has a problem with it. So does the Iranians. And that would make the options of Saudi Arabia are very, very limited. And that's why he looked for support and assuring words from Donald Trump.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a purge of princes, palace intrigue, a prime minister in limbo, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, and what's going on in the Middle East. It has been a wild time there. Hanin Gadar is helping us look at it, visiting fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Jamal Khashoggi is with us. He's a Saudi journalist in self-exile right now in the United States, but watching very closely what's going on there. Bernard Haeckel joins us in just a moment. Here was just another piece of this puzzle. Earlier this month, there was that failed ballistic missile attack. That was new, ballistic missile attack on a Saudi airport in Riyadh. Yemen's Houthi rebels claimed responsibility for firing that missile, but Saudi Arabia has accused Iran of providing that support to the rebels. Here was an interview with CNN earlier this month, and Saudi Arabia's foreign minister, Adel Al-Jaber, saying Saudi Arabia would take appropriate measures against Iran.
We see this as an act of war. Iran cannot lob missiles at Saudi cities and towns and expect us not to take steps vis-a-vis Iran. Under the UN Charter, Article 51 of the UN Charter, the Iranians cannot sit there and interfere in the affairs of the countries of the region, whether in Lebanon, whether in Yemen, whether in Syria, whether in Iraq, whether in Bahrain, and expect to get a free pass.
Well, we'll see what that means. Bernard Haeckel joins us right now, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. Bernard Haeckel, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, trying to understand this, we want to look at outside Saudi Arabia at how they're pushing their interests right now. But can you just take us inside for a moment and explain with the sort of scale of change that Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, as the Crown Prince is called, is bringing or pushing on Saudi Arabia right now? You've called it a revolution from above, talking about radically breaking with all kinds of traditions here. What do you mean, Bernard?
Well, I think to understand Mohammed bin Salman, you have to also understand his father, the king. Who has decided that Saudi Arabia has two objectives. And this is largely in reaction, at least one of them in reaction to U.S. policy in the region since 2003. The first is to make Saudi Arabia strong enough militarily and economically strong enough to stand up to Iran, which is a regional hegemon. The second is to diversify the economy and reform the economy away from its near total dependence on oil in order to be able to build that military and political capacity to stand up to Iran. Mm-hmm. And I think the best way to see Mohammed bin Salman is he is executing those two objectives simultaneously. And the arrests that we saw over the weekend,
yes,
in fact, are the result of a 3-year investigation and an attempt to, as Jamal correctly said, to end this culture of corruption and impunity that many princes operated under, and that he wants that to end. You cannot reform the economy without ending that culture of corruption.
I mean, you can't get away from the oil-dependent economy without ending the corruption. Why not?
Because they just simply eat too much of the public treasury. I mean, it costs Saudi Arabia, this corruption costs Saudi Arabia on an annual basis anywhere between 10 to 30% of the fiscal budget. That's unsustainable.
Wow. The Hariri move then. Let's begin to look beyond Saudi Arabia. How does that factor in here?
Well, the Hariri move is a complicated one because he is both you know, the Prime Minister of Lebanon, and therefore a regional actor, a regional personality. But he's also deeply entrenched in this culture of corruption that I mentioned just now. And to me, it seems that in putting pressure on him, as Hanin pointed out, they were trying to kind of perhaps, you know, kill two birds with one stone, which is to both send a message to Iran and to Hezbollah that their practices in Yemen, namely that Lebanese Hezbollah forces are in Yemen lobbing ballistic missiles at Saudi Arabia, that has to stop. And they also, I think, want to have him perhaps as a witness in these corruption trials or these corruption cases that they're engaged in. At the moment, what's happening is the Crown Prince hopes to reach a settlement with something like 80% of the 206 or 208 people who've been arrested and not to go to court. But if those people will refuse to reach a settlement, a financial settlement with the government, then he will go to court and he does have the documentation to prove their corruption.
I mean, reach a settlement, we're hearing about pretty raw grabs of assets right now and some considerable number of these detainees who have needed medical attention. It sounds like it's rough. I know they got held at the Ritz-Carlton, but it sounds like it's rough.
No, I don't think so. I don't buy the argument that it's rough. You don't, you know, if you want to be rough, you send people to jail and to prison. You don't put them in the 5-star hotel.
Well,
so I don't buy that claim that we saw today in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm. Medical attention
and also
for
there are no seizure of assets. He's basically you know, made their accounts stop. I mean, they can't seize their own assets from their accounts, but he hasn't taken their assets yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there they stand. Callers for all three of you, Hanin Gadar, Jamal Khashoggi, and Bernard Haykel. Hamid is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hamid, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I agree with most of your guests about what they're saying about Lebanon and Saudi Arabia. But I would say, let's look at the big picture. In Saudi Arabia, to understand what's going on in Lebanon, look to Saudi Arabia inside. There is a prince he's looking for to get to the power. So what he's doing in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Qatar also,
yeah,
is he's showing that he can control the region and just wait until he be a king, that he will calm down all those issues to show to the region that he can have the power to control all those files. So Lebanon is not disconnected from Saudi Arabia. It's just a smoking screen to cover what's going on inside the kingdom.
Ahmed, we've got it. Jamal, he's flexing his muscles to show that he can be the king and he can be the big dog in the region. What do you say?
I don't think so. I think he already in control. He already won the throne.
I mean, his father's still there, but he's fully lined up to have it.
Totally. His mm-hmm. father delegated all responsibilities to him, and his climb to the throne is very much secure. There are no challenges. But again, I will repeat what I said. He is doing the right things the wrong way. There had to be more assertive Saudi policies, but he is doing it the wrong way, and it is firing back on us.
Let's go to Elaine in Bar Harbor, Maine. Elaine, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, yes. I would like to know why the Saudi government is terrorizing Yemeni children. We watch the BBC every night at our
mm-hmm,
house.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Saudi government, I don't know, what is the strategy here that they are bombing these children? And it's just appalling. And I would like to know what the U.S. is doing about this.
There's been pretty indiscriminate bombing sometimes. There's no question about that. Let me get one more, Elaine, and we'll look at it. Darnell in New Orleans. Darnell, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Just one quick question for your commentator.
Mm-hmm.
It's been ignored. The situation in Yemen, the blockade. I heard the Crown Prince and our government showing support for corruption, and that's all well and good. But what about the 7 to 14 million that face famine in Yemen due to this blockade and the carpet bombing the Saudis are doing and that we're pretty much condoning on our end? I'll hang up and listen.
Darnell, thank you. Bernard, how about it? I mean, not condoning corruption, but fighting it. I get that. But lots of people around the world have looked at the indiscriminate attacks in Yemen. We've seen lots of civilian casualties there, blockade, a risk of famine. What's the Saudi strategy? And what about, is there any, I mean, we've seen standards quite ignored elsewhere as well in Syria and beyond, but what about in Yemen?
Well, the Saudi strategy in Yemen is a very simple one. They want to prevent Iran from producing a proxy non-state actor similar to Hezbollah in Lebanon that would then place 100,000 missiles on the southern Saudi border and lob missiles and threaten Saudi cities and Saudi citizens. I mean, that is essentially the Saudi strategy, to stop Iran from doing that. The proxy actor in Yemen is a group called the Houthis, who are completely under the control and are armed by Iran. To do that, the Saudis have imposed a blockade and have bombed missing targets, but it has not been carpet bombing. Some 10,000 Yemeni citizens have died as a result of the Saudi bombardment. But Yemen was already in a civil war before the Saudis got involved in this blockade.
But why so much indiscriminate? You may not say carpet, but it certainly has looked indiscriminate. Is this just a lack of expertise on the Saudi part? Is it a strategy to terrorize the population?
No, I think it's exactly that. I mean, it is that the Saudis have never waged a war before, and they just simply don't have the capacity and knowledge to use those weapons properly and accurately. They're getting better at it, and they have American support and American advisors who are training them to become better, and they have gotten better over time. But even the U.S., with our best training, often do the same thing.
A lot of suffering there. Brendan in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Brendan, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I was just wondering when America will stop funding the Saudis in militarily to attack the Yemenis, because we are culpable in a lot of collateral damage that's happening there. And I think that Donald Trump, who said he was against the war in Iraq, this doesn't follow policies that he said he supported. And I just wanted to get that comment out there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brendan. Hanin, what about U.S. interests and Saudi interests? How do you see them lining up in Yemen, in Lebanon, beyond? Are they well aligned or not here?
Well, they should be. Logically, they should be. If Iran is considered an enemy to Saudi Arabia and an enemy to the U.S., they should be aligned. And the rhetoric is actually very similar. We hear a lot of rhetoric about stopping Iran in the region and containing Iran in the region, in Syria and Iraq. But when it comes to reality, we see soft diplomacy, anti-Iran diplomacy by the U.S. in Iraq, by supporting Abadi in the upcoming elections, by working with Abadi. And Saudi Arabia is also working with Abadi. So in Iraq, you see more alignment. In Syria, not really, because in Syria, the Trump administration wants to contain Iran, but they think at one point that Russia will be successful at the de-escalation zones, at the agreements, etc., so giving this a chance. The Saudis are not happy with that. The land bridge is almost complete, and they feel that this is these agreements and de-escalation zones are actually benefiting the Iranians, because the Russians, at the end of the day, cannot stop the Iranians. Let's be clear about that. In Lebanon, Saudi Arabia's priority really now is the security of the Gulf, more than Lebanon or Syria or anywhere else. They care about Iran's involvement in the rest of the region, but it's mostly about the Gulf. Theoretically speaking, yes, they are aligned, but in reality, they're only aligned in Iraq at this point. In Yemen, maybe because of the support that they're getting from the U.S., but it's still not enough. There should be more, and maybe the U.S. can do more in Yemen than it can in Syria or Lebanon. So this might change at one point, but really, like the Yemen situation or Lebanon situation, this is not separate from the rest of the region. This is when you talk about Yemen, you cannot talk about Yemen without talking about Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, and the same for everything. This is a regional conflict, and it cannot be resolved in one place. It will not be resolved in Yemen unless it's resolved somewhere else. It's a really bigger conflict, and we need to think about it. Look at these four countries every time we analyze one of them or one crisis. It's really about all of them.
Let me get a call from Mudafar in Quincy, Massachusetts. Mudafar, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. It's very sad to hear your panel speaking kind of imaginary things. The whole reality, I'm from Iraq myself. What's going on, and the reality is reflecting the event.
What's imaginary, Mudafar? What sounds imaginary to you?
like the academic who mentioned that Hezbollah bring 100,000 muscles to the Saudi border and target the cities. This is an imaginary thing. The whole problem is Saudis were relying on the sectarian ideology to have the proxy war with Iran or with the Shiite by destabilizing Iraq and destabilizing Syria. And they tried with Lebanon, but they failed because of the political settlement there. Now, after the defeat of such ideology by the hand
of... You mean Wahhabism? You mean the sort of hardline fundamental Sunni?
Is the background, and Jamal Khashoggi knows that more than anyone.
Yeah, okay.
And so they got defeated on this front. Now, Mohammed ibn Salman trying to flip into a deal between Israel and Saudi. Saudi destabilized Lebanon to secure Israel. Israel will push United States through Kushner and Trump to protect whatever policy Saudi is doing. The internal struggle is just a matter of power. Disciplines want to have the absolute power. There is no sense of reforming. The whole kingdom is corrupt because of the unstabilized dogma of having a family control the wealth of the country.
Mudaffar, your points are powerful. Let me put them to Bernard Haykel. Bernard, our time is short, but what about the charge? It was Saudis who, you know, rolled out a lot of fundamentalist Islam, Wahhabism, and so on, and it did not work out well for them, and now here we are.
Well, they did not roll out ISIS, so that accusation is not true, and your caller is clearly, on one side of this divide.
Well, are you on one side, though? Are you on a Saudi side as opposed to an Iran side?
No, I'm on America's side, actually, and I care about the stability of the region.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that one side in this conflict, this geopolitical conflict, Iran, is trying to destabilize the region and try to get rid of the United States from the region. And another side is pro-American and wants stability.
Mm-hmm.
So I am for stability.
Jamal, are we headed for stability?
I don't know. But we need more involvement from the American administration. But they need, first of all, to speak in one voice. Those dual voices are confusing everybody in the region. They need to speak in one voice and become more interested because the region should not be left alone.
Hanin, very quickly, is this related to the Trump administration talking about a deal in Israel, trying to make peace there? Or is that entirely different?
No, I think that's entirely different. It's the Syria might be related, but I think this is separate.
All right, one step at a time. But what a wonderful curtain drawback here today, and I'm grateful to the three of you for doing it. Mudaffar, we hear your line of critique. At the same time, grateful for what we've learned. Bernard Haykel at Princeton, our thanks to you. Jamal Khashoggi in Washington today. Hanin Gadar at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, our thanks to each of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.